How are bold ideas born and which ones survive to eventually shake up the status quo? We'll hear straight from our industry's greatest visionaries who are making waves and learn how they turned their dreams into disruptive reality. This is From Dreamers to Disruptors, a podcast powered by Medidata.
Hi, everyone. I'm Anthony Costello, CEO of Medidata. Welcome to our podcast, From Dreamers to Disruptors. I'm honored today to have as our guest one of my great friends in this industry, Jessica Federer. And Jess, you know, first of all, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Very excited about our conversation. I know we've had a couple prep conversations and we have enough ideas and notes here to probably talk for 3 or 4 hours. So
yes, let's not do that.
Let's cut it to 2 hours or so. No.
Sounds good.
I was thinking about how to introduce you properly. And because you're such an industry rock star, extraordinaire, breaking through walls, disrupting nonstop for years now, I wanted to, help our audience understand maybe a little bit of that background. You've done a lot of great things, but take us back to the beginning, maybe moving into the digital space much earlier than it was a thing. And also as one of the first women to really ever hold an office like chief digital officer. So can we start there?
Sounds good. You make me sound old. So I had the great privilege of being the first chief digital officer for Bayer. I was actually the second chief digital officer in the pharmaceutical industry. My friend Bruno over at Teva at the time was the first. And it was the early days of digital, right? You know, you still had to explain to people, what does a chief digital officer do? And, you know, when you're a big 150-year-old organization, and I think at the time we had around 120,000 people in the company, anytime you start to do it, something as big and wide-reaching as a digital transformation, it involves so many parts. And it ends up being, 90% cleanup and 10% cool stuff. But it is really a systematic approach to change management. And I think, I might have been a little overly optimistic that chief digital officers could maybe more quickly transform these big pharma giants than they actually did. You know, I think you're always really optimistic at the beginning. Otherwise, you wouldn't have said yes to doing it.
I don't know anything about that. Yeah.
But we made progress, right? And that was the now everyone has a chief digital officer. Everyone is taking an integrated approach to their data, to their technology, ensuring that they're not investing in 20 different countries with 100 different partners in ways that contradict each other. There's a much more streamlined approach, so you get the value out of the data. And I always use the example with the Bayer team of, what does a chief digital officer do? Let's imagine you need a pacemaker put into your heart. So who do you want to put the pacemaker into your heart? The techie that knows every single little component of that pacemaker, the wiring, the chip, the type of batteries and metals. Do you want the techie putting it into your heart, or do you want the cardiologist who is looking at the overall systematic integration to get, the best health outcome overall to do that integration? And often in time in pharma, we get really caught up in the techie piece. You know, who made the pacemaker? What's the smallest chip? What type of design is it? Instead of thinking about that overarching, what is the integration going to look like? And how do we do that with the least amount of pain, the least amount of disruption, the quickest recovery possible? Because the whole goal is to get the entire organism running faster and better, not just that one thing.
Sure. Well, and I think, you kind of just touched on, in a way, why digital adoption can be such a challenge in our industry, because we're not short on inventing cool digital tools, but what makes it difficult, and, I'll speak for us at Medidata, what makes it difficult is that by the time you figure out how is it going to work with a clinical trial, meaning an IRB and a patient and a site and a sponsor and a CRO. And, if that's the organism of say the trial design, it can be very difficult. And I think the whole origin of this podcast is really how do you take in this case, a digital dream, right? Yeah. Like some very exciting new digital innovation, but then work it through the steps that it takes to actually get widespread adoption so that it can become some sort of disruption eventually.
Yeah, that's the secret of disruption. That in between the dream and the successful disruption is a incredibly frustrating amount of process. And, you know, that's the magic of getting anything done at scale, is it has to go from exciting to boring. It has to become put into such a process that it is literally, it's boring and tedious, and that's what makes it scalable. So we often get really excited about the new things, but they're so far away from being scaled out into implementation.
Mm-hmm. The hype curve is something that we talk about a lot here.
It's real.
And so I know in your more recent career,
yes,
you've gotten into kind of an investor advisor position that's allowed you to touch tons of different things that are dreamy and could become disruptive. But before we jump to that, I want to just stick with your bear role for one second, because, you know, one of the things that I think our industry needs are more people that come from a big pharma organization, or, you know, maybe academics too, but large organizations that have the ability to really adopt these things and make them disruptive by changing the industry. And you were in that position for a long time. Look at, you talked about pacemakers, but are there any other examples or stories maybe you could tell about being on the pharma side, 120,000 employees, global reach, thousands of trials being run, thousands of digital innovations being considered? You know, any examples of sort of latching onto something in the dreamy stage and figuring this could be disruptive and how can I help push it through to that stage?
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you. We need more leaders coming inside of organizations because the hard part of successfully deploying tech to deliver a health outcome, to deliver an efficiency in the clinical trial speed, to deliver something better, faster, cheaper, that requires the inside knowledge and expertise. And we hear a lot about, oh, bringing in the externals with a fresh perspective. That's great and that's fun, but sometimes you really need to know the details and the ins and outs of an industry as complex as making a drug, getting it through trials, and getting it to your medicine cabinet around the world. So that really requires a deep expertise from inside. And it's often like having a PhD in the organization. So to your question, and I love this question because there's so many things I'm proud about from my time at Bayer. And I got to work with so many incredible people. I think we looked at it in a number of perspectives. You know, I can break it into people, processes, platforms, and partnerships. And if you're looking enterprise-wide, you need every one of those components to make a change in technology. And we always start with the people. And I would say, you know, the technology is easy compared to people. I'll never forget the time that we had brought a lot of our chief legal officers from different countries together in Europe at Google's office in Hamburg. And we were teaching them all about, you know, sort of like a digital 101 for lawyers. And one of the counsel for a pretty big country in Europe, like, literally asked, wait a second. Does this mean people don't have the same IP address their entire life? And you're like, oh, that explains why nothing in that country was getting improved through the LMR. Because the legal colleagues hadn't had that basic training yet. And once they did, man, they were amazing partners at getting things approved. So the people element of designing a strategy that brings people along with you, that brings the culture along with you, and then, you know, the next one I mentioned was process. In a large organization, people just don't go off and do whatever they want. There's a lot of process, a lot of SOPs. And one of the most efficient ways of delegating and leading in a new space is to have something in the scorecard of the CEO. And once you get it in the scorecard of the CEO, it's in every scorecard, every level down. And that is a priority for every single person in the organization if they want to get their bonus that year. And so looking at what are the processes and what are the levers that help institutionalize the changes you're trying to make, help make it routine, help bring it into the organization in a way that it's not going to seem new or novel in a year. Those processes and SOP changes make a tremendous difference.
Sure.
Exciting things. I didn't get to the exciting things yet. I think everything on the using technology to get us from selling things to selling outcomes is super exciting.
Yep.
So we have that in digital pharma. Moving to having an integration of data in near real time where you can move from selling an injection to selling, you know, lines of vision gained. You can move to focusing on just the outcome for the reimbursement. And the same in digital farming, going from selling seeds and fertilizers and pesticides to selling a crop yield guarantee to big farms, which is ultimately what they want, is use the microclimate data and the satellite data to deliver a crop yield guarantee. And so moving from selling something to the outcome that everyone wants, that's really the exciting promise of digital and the exciting promise of technology. And then, of course, you know, I actually find the most boring, least sexy things to probably be the most exciting, because if you're looking to make change across 120,000 people, it's really not anything that's big or shiny. It's the little quiet process changes that make a big difference. And so, you know, having the organizational structure to be able to know what you're doing, because digital is still so new. And many of our companies are still doing a lot of initiatives in different therapeutic areas in different countries. And there's so much great stuff going on. But until it's all in a harmonized, transparent perspective, you can't benefit from all of that great innovation if it's all siloed.
One of the things I like about your new role in the industry, or kind of, I mean, I guess I should say the way you've positioned yourself, right? You've purposely put yourself in this position where I think you see a lot of this stuff at the very fledgling kind of grassroots level. You pick out the things that you think have some high potential. You've got a particular focus on women's health. And also, I think it's fair to say, on investment dollars being put in the direction of helping women run companies, female CEOs. Like, you can talk, you know, you can explain more about what this is, but I think, you know, to your point about when something gets to be holistic and disruptive and as you said, easy enough to adopt that it fits into something like a CEO's set of goals, it's been through a lot of walls to get there. Like, it's broken through. It was some seed-funded idea that everyone thought was crazy, and then it got a little bit of traction and a single customer, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Yes. And then it ends up someday being like a guaranteed crop yield, and everyone goes like, duh, right? But there's a lot of steps between here and there, and you've kind of, I think, become one of our industry's experts at seeing those things early and picking the right ones. So, you know, maybe you could talk about a couple of those, some of the things that I guess I want to hear what you think is most interesting now that will become one of these sort of boring-ish disruptions down the road, because we've taken it through all these phases to get there. And then also, like, why is it that women's health has been so, I mean, I'll just say overlooked for such a long time? And is that trend starting to change? I know it's not enough change, but are you feeling like there is a change in motion that we can all work to build on now?
Two great questions. All right, I'll start with the first one. The trend in this space now that I think we're a good ways into the evolution of is digital therapeutics. And I know you guys had some news recently in this space. So I think it's a no-brainer that at some point soon, most new drugs coming to market will have a digital component to them, that we will have a much higher adoption of digital therapeutics because it delivers on the promise of precision medicine. It delivers on the ability to be adaptable, whether you're 6'6" or 4'10". You know, it delivers on the promise of being responsive and passive and part of your life in a way that it makes so much sense when you're looking at improving health outcomes that it's inevitable. The challenge is, like with anything new, you go through that adoption curve. You go through the hype cycle. You go through so many investors getting excited about a space that know nothing about it. So the valuations go to places they probably shouldn't. You know, you go through all of these steps, but at the end of the day, the goal's still the same. We're going to use tech to improve people's lives. And this is one that makes so much sense. And yes, we still have to figure out the ways to make it the most scalable and the most intuitive. And yes, it does have to be paid for. But it's inevitable. We'll get there.
Agreed.
Tell me a little bit about your vision.
Well, we're, you know, I mean, thanks for mentioning our recent investment in Click Therapeutics. So, I mean, we are big believers in digital therapeutics. We chose to partner with Click and to invest in them because we think they have a unique approach to this. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The recent history, 10, 15 year history now in companion apps or digital therapeutics is sort of littered with fits and starts, right? There's companies that have come and completely been wiped out. There's companies that had great ideas but never got the right investment. What we think is different about Click is that they actually have run the phase 2 and 3 clinical trials to show the empirical evidence that the drug in combination, they call it software enhanced drugs or SE drugs, but the drug with an SE app that goes along with it actually, according to FDA and according to the outcomes of the research, actually show a clinical benefit above and beyond the drug alone, which can lead to a label claim. So, you know, I think this is the next era, we hope, of digital therapeutics, that they're actually in the label and that they are seen as prescribed hand in glove with a drug or a medical device to enhance the patient outcome beyond what the drug was going to do alone. And so that would be very, very disruptive compared to what we've seen in the past with very exciting companion apps that drive behavior or measure, you know, this or that, but they're not in the label and they're not seen, as you said, as something that really can objectively help any patient anywhere because the clinical trial was designed to prove that.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy to see you teaming up with Click. I think it's a really smart combination too. I mean, how many clinical trials have you done now? What was it, 35,000 some?
Plus, yeah, 35, 36,000.
The number, the scale, the breadth. If you're looking at making anything sustainable, the secret in our industry is to partner with one of the giants, because if they can find a way to make it work inside their organization, they can find a way to roll it out in a way that'll work for the other organizations in the space. And so I'm very encouraged seeing your partnership with Click, because that means we're expediting that evolution curve. It's going to come even faster. It's still inevitable. It's still on its way, but this is going to make it a much faster adoption and rollout, is having the benefit of the metadata dissociation systems for scale. And when it comes to technology, the scale is all that matters. You know, that's why your credit card works in different countries and your plane can land in different countries, is because we have harmonized in a way to enable the scale and the reach. Mm-hmm. And this organization has a big enough scale and reach that if you can successfully partner that in, which you've done, that means we're moving much faster.
That's certainly our dream, and our customers are responding positively to this too, right? Because they want, maybe just all the way back to the start of our discussion here, it's like big customers like Bayer, and many others, you know, if they want a digital therapeutics program, what they're signing up for in a lot of ways is we're going to prove that this thing works with our drug. Yes. It goes in our drug label.
Yes.
And then our patients are prescribed this thing forever.
Yes.
And that's hard to do with a startup that's relatively new, relatively small, still raising rounds of funding.
Maybe you're not out of budget while you're in between studies.
And I think this is why, maybe it's part of the explanation for why companion apps have sort of stayed in that zone of companion-y, but not in the label. Because once you make that move, you are part of the IP of that therapeutic treatment. And there's got to be enough support to run that in perpetuity that the pharma companies want to bite it off in the first place. So, you know, we hope to be able to combine Clix's novel, inventive kind of design and the way that they've been able to validate their modules for these apps with our ability to have, like you said, the global reach and all the trials and all the customers. If we can bring those things together, we might jump the hype curve, you know, a little bit faster. And that's what we're trying to do.
I think you just hit on one of the big challenges in our space is that often the exciting new innovations are done by these very young companies. And if you're going to put anything in your label, it doesn't matter how cool it is, you need to know it's going to be around in 5, 10, 15 years. And that sustainability and that reliability and that strong governance and strong regulatory capability, you don't have that in the really young companies. And so, you know, it is a really complicated pairing when you're trying to bring startups and big pharma together. And I think that's actually why we're seeing some of the largest tech adoption not coming from the startups. You know, Bessemer Ventures just released a new report yesterday on AI and healthcare, and it's showing it's the larger tech companies and the larger pharma companies are doing these things increasingly in-house. So either, you know, that they will bring in partners, they will bring in startups, but they're really trying to build capabilities even more than they were before. We've been having this buyer, build, or partner conversation forever. But to get the sustainability, to have the reliance that, yes, this company will be here in 15, 20 years so we can pursue a label with this in it, you just need that. You need that heft.
Yep, exactly. So that's what we're hoping to do. And you
I'm sure you'll do it.
You talked earlier about the responsibility. I don't know if you use that word, but I view it as the responsibility of companies like Dasosis, them, Medidata, large pharma to take some chances on these dreamy ideas so that we all have the hope to kind of get it to disruption. And, you know, we're seeing AI make that jump in our industry now. I don't know your thoughts on that, but I, you know.
What are your thoughts on
that? Well, it's not about me. It's your podcast. That's
What are your thoughts on AI?
Well, I mean, we at Medidata, we have kind of a special AI program, and we're heavily invested in that and trying to leverage these historical trials into a specialized data set that does the learning. That supports the AI algorithms in a way that's very closely tied to the history of clinical research because we've done so many more studies than anyone else. We think we can help customers better design a future trial because of the deep expertise, the kind of knowledge and know-how we've accumulated by running so many earlier trials in the industry. And we, you know, we're rolling that AI into all of our different experiences, we call them, so that no matter what part of our system you're using, you're getting the benefit of some kind of AI. Mm-hmm. There are also challenges with AI, as I'm sure you would
be. You're there?
You would point out that if the AI has learned from a particular set of use cases, then the AI is going to spit out suggestions based on that set of use cases. And so, you know, I really want to pivot to your work and your focus on women in research and, you know, studies that focus on women and women that are leaders of companies that are focused in healthcare and, you know, maybe therefore challenges with AI that are largely based on clinical trials run on men.
That was
right?
Beautifully woven together.
So
well done.
I'd like to hear kind of how you've pieced this together in your mind, because you really are on the cutting edge of changing this pattern. And I think you've been there since Bayer and many of the things that you've done since then.
All right. So I think for your listeners who aren't aware, women were not included in clinical trials in the U.S. till 1993. That's the year the movie Jurassic Park came out, the original. Also the year Groundhog Day came out. For many of us, that is very recent history. And that was just the first time women were required to be in federally funded studies. So we're playing a lot of catch up when it comes to understanding sex-based differences in our industry. And, you know, when you're just looking at how do you run a good business, you got to know your customer. And if half of your customers weren't really included in the data gathering for a long time, you have some risk. And that's why a lot of the last, there was an Office of the Inspector General report showing that a number of the last drugs recalled from the market were due to differences, sex-based differences that weren't seen in the studies because they weren't powered to see the sex-based differences. Mm-hmm. And so we're playing a lot of catch up when it comes to women, when it comes to women's health, when it comes to this precision medicine dream that we all have of providing the right care to the right patient at the right time. Your 23rd chromosome, whether you have an X and a Y or an X and an X, does count as part of that precision care, and it makes a big difference. And so, you know, we're at a place now where 80% of autoimmune disease is in female patients, 80%. 2/3 of Alzheimer's patients are women. And women are still 50% more likely to die in the year after a heart attack than men. 50%. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death for women. And we don't know why there's these sex-based differences, because women really weren't researched. And so from a data perspective, if you're coming from the data world, you know that, okay, we're missing some data, but thanks to technology now, we can leapfrog. We can look at the data that's there. We can use the data that exists. We can jump ahead using technology and make up for the data gaps. But it's an exciting space. I actually think it might be the most exciting space in science today is women's health. And the reason is just because of what we don't know. So I was talking to some grad students over at Wharton a few weeks ago, and I asked them, what was the first year we got to see inside a woman's brain while she was pregnant? You know, when was it? And they were guessing like, oh, in the 90s, in the early 2000s. And so they were guessing all these great numbers. But, you know, it was really just last year that we had a publication with regular MRI scans of a woman's brain while she was pregnant. And it was the first time we saw how the brain structure changes during pregnancy. And here we're pretty advanced when it comes to science. You know, we're using tech to do all these great things. And this is the very first time we've seen in a woman's brain. We're also really struggling to understand why are women 2/3 of Alzheimer's disease? And it's not the age variable. So, you know, the studies looking at how hormones change in the brain, how the activity levels in the brain change. This is all very new science. And even I was reading this morning one of the articles that just came out about the gene differences when it comes to Alzheimer's for women. And it was talking about the silent X chromosome. Now, first, let's just stop and admire the hubris of someone to just assume an entire chromosome you have is silent because you have two of them. So, you know, just appreciating that's the science we're coming from. So, yes, of course, now researchers are very excited to see that the silent X chromosome is actually not silent. It actually is activated during different parts of your life. It is active and probably has quite a role to play in some of these spaces that we don't know a lot about. And if you think about the women in your life, if you think about the fact that every human life on the planet comes out of women's health, and yet we don't know this much about it, it becomes a very exciting new space where we can realize innovations and changes quickly. It becomes an opportunity area, unlike, well, we don't get many opportunity areas like this, where in our lifetime, we know the changes that we can make. We know the progress that is possible. And so you talked about investment. I'm a big fan of bringing more investors into the women's health space. I started a meeting over at the New York Stock Exchange. We bring together investors once a year to the Health of Women Investor Summit. Investors from private equity, VC, even, you know, corporate venture capital, endowments, foundations, governments, you name it, to increase investment in a space where we all will benefit from the innovation. And it's been nice because we launched this meeting a couple of years ago, and the largest dedicated women's health fund at that time was $40 million. I know.
Wow.
That's just, can't believe it. And now, 2 years later, we have funds being announced at this event that are 7 and 8 times that size. And so if every couple of years we keep seeing a 7 or 8 times increase, then we're getting closer to the amount of capital that probably should be dedicated to such an important area. So I'm particularly optimistic. And in a lot of it, circling back to digital technologies, it is going to require the use of digital technologies to make these steps and to make this progress possible. It also makes it much more accessible. If we think about people in clinical trials, and we know women are the chief medical officers of the home, we know they control most of the spending in the home. We know they take care of their parents' generation and their children's generation. If we can use technology to help them participate in advancing science, then we'll move a lot faster. So the digital and the women's health angles really come together, because at the end of the day, it's a really fast way to create change.
Yeah. And it seems like things are lined up for that now. There's not, I don't know who could offer any sort of reasonable explanation about why it took so long. But if you have, you know, you, as you pointed out, you have half or more than half of the consumer base, you have the technology available to do it, you have the willingness, you have the investment dollars now being put in the right place. We've got plenty of clinical trials. All of them are notoriously hard to enroll. I think there's lots of reasons why it can be challenging for women to join clinical trials because of, you know, many of the other sort of life circumstances going on. But there's diversity initiatives in clinical research to achieve better diversity goals in trial recruitment. You know, those aren't perfect, and those are going to take years probably to really play out the way that we hope. But there's a lot of, I'll say, sort of pieces lined up for this to improve very, very quickly now. Do you think that it will? Or is there something else that we should be doing? I mean, as an industry?
Yes, and yes. Yes, I think it will. And yes, there's more we can do. So I'm privileged now to sit on the boards of some really outstanding organizations, you know, a public biotech company active in the women's health space, a digital health company, you know, changing how research is done. I'm on the board of a VC based out of Rome, Angelini Ventures, that is investing in new biotech and health tech companies. And we've done a number of really dedicated women's health investments in the space. And it's exciting to see the women's health space mainstreaming. And I think it's important because probably the term women's health is the wrong term. You know, if you think it's 80% of autoimmune patients and 2/3 of Alzheimer's patients, you know, women's health doesn't really capture that. So regardless of what the term is, really understanding, and maybe it just goes back to precision medicine, but how different people respond so differently. And you know, that's the fun part about what you guys do too at Medidata. You have the breadth and the depth of 30-something thousand trials, and to have really intelligent AI so that you can get the information about how different people, different populations at different stages in their life are going to respond differently. And then we use that to reduce risk to the companies that are making a new intervention. But more importantly, we're using that to tailor a solution to help improve lives for people, which is what we all want to do. That's why we're here.
So I feel like you're kind of starting to get into where we love to end these podcasts, which is you've got to help us get a call to action. And I feel like in this talk, we've been circling around calls to action the whole time, right? Because if you're nibbling at innovative, dreamy ideas, but they have to somehow become disruptive, there's many actions that have to take place all throughout that kind of timeline to bring these things across the finish line. So, you know, we've covered a lot of ground here, but if we sort of stick with where we're at right now, we've got these initiatives. It doesn't have to be thought of as women's health, because it can be thought of as brain health in the case of Alzheimer's, for example. Yeah. We're moving towards precision medicine. Precision medicine will help us understand the way people react differently to therapeutic options, whether they're men or women or, you know, any other type of demographic group that we want to measure. Mm-hmm. Digital therapeutics all the while can also help enhance the visibility into what's happening, maybe even in the case of some of the things Click has done, accelerate the value of the therapy and so on. So, you know, can you sum that all up for us in a call to action that you can give the millions of people that will listen to this podcast?
Just millions?
Well, I was taking a little leap there, but what do you want us to do? And you know, Medidata too, like, what do you want all of us to do to make this stuff disruptive faster, so it's like lives in the dream state a little less long and it gets to the change state faster?
All right, I'm going to give you two. First, I want everybody listening to this podcast and everyone in the pharma industry and pharma adjacent, CRO adjacent industries to enroll in a clinical trial. I cannot tell you how often I hear an executive at a pharma company or a CRO talking about the patient experience or the clinical trial experience. And then I ask them, oh, when was the last study you were in? And they've never been in a clinical trial. So if you're going to work in this industry, you need to participate in a clinical trial. It's just doing your homework. It's getting the experience of the person that matters most. And stepping back, it is always important to reflect on the fact that we work in an industry that runs on volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
We work in a trillion-dollar industry that runs on volunteers. And until you have volunteered and you've been in that really uncomfortable situation in a hospital gown going for a scan or waiting for a blood draw or wondering if your information was uploaded correctly, and if you're going to get a copy of the consent form and where did it go to, until you do that and you do that regularly, you're probably not in the best position to create change that's really meaningful for that end user. So first, sign up for a study. If you don't know what study you can sign up for, I'm going to recommend just go to joinallofus.com, which is the NIH study. It's been running for 10 years. It has close to 1 million Americans in it. Enroll in that. Go give some blood and urine. Participate in the clinical trial that the NIH is running with 1 million Americans. It's just important to be part of it. Then, so that's what every single person can do on their own in this space. And frankly, if you're going to talk about patient experience at any event or conference or podcast, you got to be in a clinical trial and you got to be ready to encourage people to be in clinical trials. So once you're in a trial, tell people about it. Break down the stigma around clinical trial participation. I was talking with a researcher who I love here based in New York, Dr. Lisa Musconi. She wrote the XX Brain, the woman's brain. And she was doing these menopause studies a few years ago and really struggling to get women to enroll in the clinical trial because it requires an MRI and a PET scan. And so I threw a dinner party, literally a dinner party, and invited so many women. And I said, there's a catch. You're going to have to listen to this researcher, and I'm going to ask you to see if you're eligible to enroll in her study. And, you know, everybody wanted to participate. Once they learned about the research, they met the researcher in a non-clinical setting. They learned how they could help contribute to an understanding of the brain. Of course they want to participate. And then they know their friends are doing it. They don't feel so bad going and getting their MRIs. So make it accessible. So do it and share it. Now, let's get down to our corporate identities and our business and our mission of transforming healthcare through data and technology, which is what you're passionate about and what I'm passionate about and why people are probably listening to this podcast. You know, I think it's time to go ahead and set a goal that digital therapeutics become integrated and become more commonplace within the next 5 years. I think we can go ahead and just set some clear goals and work backwards towards it. And in every one of our organizations, we're very adept, especially in big pharma, at making the 10-year plan, the 5-year plan. But there's always an end. What is that end? Is it launching the product in 10 years? Okay, so then, you know, 4 years out, we're going to start our market access preparation and training our KOLs. And, you know, 6 years out, where are we? So you work backwards. So I think it's time to set a goal and say, we know that digital integration to traditional therapies is on its way. It's coming. let's say here's the date we want to have that be commonplace. So then that means we've got to work backwards. We need a couple of years before that for it to be new before it gets to commonplace. And then what are the barriers? Who are the partners around the table? What are the ecosystem changes? What are the regulatory or reimbursement changes that will take a few years to make? And just make the pragmatic plan of how we're going to do that together, and share it, because none of us work in a vacuum. And in our industry, it doesn't matter what one company does. We need all of our companies to be doing similar things with similar approach and similar guidelines if we're going to get the scale that we need. So I sign up for a trial and put together a plan, start at the end and then work backwards.
Yeah. I think those are two great calls to action. And, you know, I was thinking when you were talking about a 5-year plan to digital therapeutics, which I love, of course, but, you know, you won't be shocked, but maybe some of our listeners would be shocked to know the number of times that we still run into customers that are doing paper data capture for clinical trials or paper data capture for eCOA or ePRO. Everybody still does paper for consent forms, right? So, you know, the traction that we've gotten in the industry over the last 10, 15 years on bringing digital to clinical trials sets us up in a great way to bring digital therapeutics now into the commercial setting and the label, as we've talked about. But there's so much that we could also do earlier in that value chain to just bring digital to the trial so that the trial happens as fast as possible and you get to an outcome or an answer that the drug or digital therapeutic doesn't work. Yeah. You know, we need to get to those you know, bad answers sooner too, because the always limited investment dollars should be put in the best place. And those are the places that we can have the most likely success.
Yeah. And I'm going to put one more out there. I think it's time that everyone participating in a clinical trial gets a tax credit. So if you participate in a clinical trial, you get a tax credit. And if we want to encourage clinical trial participation and we want to encourage people to go out of their comfort zone and go out of their way to advance science that will benefit all of us, we need to put the right incentives in place. And right now, actually, participants can be taxed on what they're getting out of a clinical trial. And so they should be getting a credit. And if you get a credit for making a donation to a nonprofit, you should certainly get a tax credit for making a donation of your physical cells and your samples and your time and your disease experience. So I think if we make some industry-wide changes to make research more accessible and attractive, then we will see a greater increase in participation that will make our clinical trial enrollment much faster. It'll make our studies more robust and more diverse. So I think if we're going to put a couple other things out into the ether, that would be one that all of the companies that work with metadata and metadata themselves can probably get accomplished in the short term, is let's give everybody who participates in a clinical trial a tax credit.
All right. 3 strong calls to action. We're going to enroll in the All of Us study, which itself could yield very disruptive findings, right? I mean, the whole purpose of that trial is to get a big enough sample size that we can see some interesting signals that maybe no one knew before, right?
Yes.
So, Jess, fantastic to have you here today. Thanks for kind of jumping around and covering so much ground with me. I think it was really exciting. I think our viewers will agree. And I hope we can have you back again maybe in a year or two, and we'll do a touch base on some of these disruptive dreams.
Happy to be here. And thank you to all of your listeners. They could work in any industry, but they've chosen to work in one that improves lives. And I appreciate that and thank them for listening.
Yep. Thanks again.